You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and oh, do we have a treat for everyone today. We are joined today by the long-awaited return of the co-host himself, the man with no plan. His name is Abby.
Oh, the only plan is long only, baby. That's it. That's why I've been so MIA.
Well, speaking of, you know, the ultimate long only plan, welcome back from your much vaunted marriage.
Thank you. Yes, my recent nuptials were quite intriguing.
Well, congratulations.
That was a lot of
buddy.
Fun. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, thank you. You know, everybody's been asking me, oh, like what's been different? Well, you know, how'd you think of it? And for anyone out there who's going through this, you know, the wedding, I know Manish, you went through the whole wedding planning process. Mm-hmm. It's an absolute nightmare. You're writing checks, you're making decisions. Your every weekend, evening is sort of allocated towards wedding planning, which is a lot of fun, but at the same time, pretty stressful. I will say, and I think you will agree with me too on this, when you get to the actual event, the reception after everything is done, you're at the party, it's the best party you'll ever go to because the DJ always plays your song. The bartender always gets you your drink. Everyone you turn and look to is someone you love, someone you want to talk to. And it's like nothing that you'll ever experience again. So that's my biggest takeaway from it.
Yeah, that's great. No, that's good for you, buddy. And listen, anyone listening to this, coming to the end of the year, probably regretting some of the investment decisions you made, just imagine how Abby's wife is going to feel in a couple of years, you know? So... everything
couple
in
months,
context
actually. Yeah.
Everything has context, but listen, honestly, buddy, I'm very happy for you. Congratulations. And if anyone was wondering where Abby's been the past few weeks, that is it. He's had a lot of, you know, fun stuff to deal with, but I hear you, man. Leading up to the moment, it's a lot of headache and a lot of stress.
Yeah, exactly. But hey,
welcome back.
Yeah. Thank you.
So listen, today I want to talk about the current state of the cannabis industry. And I've got a couple of examples of companies that I think will show you, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the industry. But as we're coming up to the end of the year here, the plan is to kind of have a recap episode next week, or sorry, 2 weeks from now. And also a game plan going forward for 2024. But today I really want to chat about this idea of where the industry is, where the companies are, and where the cannabis consumer is. So that's really the agenda for today. And we're going to kind of look at three different scenarios, namely with Verano, Forefront, and Planet 13, and what these kind of tell us about the state of the industry. But before we jump into that, you know, Abby, I want to have this discussion with you about, in general, the state of the consumer in 2023. And this isn't a question that I've kind of had internally that I've bounced around with a couple of people. Are we in a recession in 2023? And I don't mean, you know, the technical definition of, you know, two contracting quarters. I mean, when you talk to different industries and different people, you get different answers on, are we in a recession? You know, on the one hand, anything that's sort of consumer facing, people will often say, hey, go look outside at what's going on in travel and hospitality and fine dining. And it doesn't seem at all that there's any recession. It seems that people are spending money more or less the same as they have been the last 1 or 2 years. But then when you talk to other industries, you know, like trucking, for example, those guys are talking like it's been, you know, almost a year long recession and things are really bad. So that's the first question I want to dig into a little bit, Abby, is are we in a recession?
You know, that's I think you did a good job just talking about very specific markets being in a recession, right? Because mm-hmm. you're right. If you do ask a lot of different people in different industries, you're going to get different answers. I think the more important question is, has consumer spending or has anyone in like on Main Street been really impacted, right? Because I do feel that certain industries are in recession, right? For example, I think like advertising is in one. I definitely think that residential realtors are in one for sure.
Sure.
You know, even if you're selling used cars, you might be insulated, but if you're selling new cars, it seems like volumes and new car transactions are going down. They're starting to discount as well. So it is very subjective to where you are and what you do for a living, right? But having said all of that, if you look at the individuals, like I know a few people who are residential realtors. I know a few people who are in the advertising industry. Their spending habits and their spending patterns haven't really changed, right? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is like, if I'm like, oh, hey, do you guys want to go out on Friday night? We're going to go out to this restaurant, et cetera. Nobody bats an eyelash. Right. And I still think that like restaurants are a good gauge of a good indication of recessions. And I think that the consumer still hasn't really felt it yet. But having said that, though, typically when you go into November, December, right after American Thanksgiving up until about Christmas time here, people are more willing to spend money, whether it's for gifts, whether it's for like purchases. There's a lot more sales going on. There's Black Friday, Cyber Monday, you know, Boxing Day. There's a whole bunch of things happening to sort of stimulate the economy. Mm-hmm. So I think in January, we'll really start to see, hey, are we in a recession right now? My answer to that is I feel that, yes, we are kind of in a recession, but I feel like the consumer is still pretty strong and sort of resilient at the moment. And maybe they're just being, you know, what's that word? Naive. Maybe not naive. I'm trying to say like they're just sort of not accepting that, you know, hey, things are changing. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. So, look, I think there's a couple of things to parse out there, right? At the end of the day, it's a consumer-driven economy. So if consumers have not pulled back, which it doesn't feel that they have, then most business feels unaffected, right? Now, again, if you parse through really specific examples, you are seeing pullbacks, right? So you mentioned, you know, residential real estate and you mentioned automobiles. Those are two things that are greatly impacted by interest rates because mm-hmm. you borrow money to buy those things, right? So I would have expected bigger declines in those areas. And instead, what you've seen is you've seen volume slow down quite a bit, but mm-hmm. you have not seen a lot of price adjustment. So that's been pretty surprising, right? And when you talk about B2B, people on the front end of the curve, so going back to trucking, but also people in the supply and logistics space, they talk about a serious slowdown happening. Now, it's also important to note that they were impacted the other way through COVID, where they had an influx of demand and they couldn't keep up, right? So there's a lot of adjustment happening where suddenly they're having to adjust to a new reality. But they were coming off such a crazy level of demand that, you know, even just a moderation of it to a normal level could feel like a pretty big slowdown, right? Mm-hmm. I think, Abby, to your point about people changing their everyday behaviors, it doesn't really feel like we've seen that. And in Canada, consumers have, you know, mortgages that are between 1 and 5 years, and a lot more people are on a variable mortgage than in the U.S. In the U.S., people mm-hmm. can lock in these 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. So ultimately, you know, people who don't need to buy a house or don't need to move or don't need to refinance, they have a lot more runway in the U.S. than they do in Canada, right? So in Canada, every year, roughly 20% of your mortgages are rolling over. People are going from, you know, 3% mortgages to 6% mortgages, give or take. That's a big bite out of your wallet, right? So even if you're doing okay, you've got a job, you've got a nice raise, you know, you're not necessarily needing to cut spending. When that interest rate expense doubles in your budget, I mean, that's going to hurt, right? Yeah. And we're still feeling that. The rates really started cranking up in kind of August of last year. We're only a year and change removed from that, right? And they talk about the fact that interest rates usually take 12 to 18 months to feel the full effect. So I totally hear what you're saying in terms of this is, you know, this week was just American Thanksgiving. That's Black Friday and Green Wednesday, I think they call it, where there's lots of cannabis sales. You're going into the Christmas season where there's lots of shopping, lots of advertising, lots of consumer spend. And ultimately, to come back to, you know, the cannabis consumer, last year we had a lot of concern around the fact that inflation was making it such that the consumer was still going to the dispensary, but the amount of money that they had left over after, you know, the cost of fuel and the cost of food meant that they were downsizing at the dispensary, and that was a big problem. This mm-hmm. year, it seems like the exact opposite. It seems like we've just come off of Q3 earnings, and to me, this was probably the strongest quarterly earnings that I can remember, you know, before, maybe thinking back to like 2021 or something like that. So The cannabis consumer, the consumer in general this year has actually been pretty strong. I think the question is what's going to happen going into next year, and are higher rates going to really start taking a bite out of what people can afford? And, you know, bigger picture too, are these rates going to put pressure on businesses that are already kind of overstretched, and do we actually start seeing some real distress that we really haven't seen up till now?
Yeah, you know, you raised a lot of points there. So I'm just going to use my own personal, myself as an example. So I recently sold a condo and I'm in the market for a house right now, right? And so about 18 months back is when I started this whole endeavor. Like, not, I didn't list the condo then, but this is when I mentally started looking at, you know,
sure,
housing prices, et cetera. I'm just going to use arbitrary numbers here, but let's say I was approved for $100,000 mortgage. Okay. Mm-hmm. Back in 2021. Right. Nothing's changed in terms of like myself, right? Still, you know, still employed, still doing the same line of work, still, you know, active. My approval now, my new mortgage approval would be 40,000 using that number.
Wow.
That's a huge difference, like a huge, huge, huge difference. And that was like within like the last like 4 months, right? And I look at myself and I look at, you know, other people who are out there. It's like, how are people buying these houses, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think there is going to be capitulation and housing prices will start to come down. To your point, you know, pricing hasn't really come down, but volume has decreased quite a bit. So I think that's something definitely to keep into consideration. That's me on the buy side of the equation. On the sell side of the equation, obviously I didn't list my condo in 2021. When I did list my condo, which was the summer of this year, you know, it was on the market for almost 35 days. And I would say I only had about 6 showings, which is really low, right? For what the condo market in Toronto was before, you were selling condos within a week and you were having bidding wars, right? So that's kind of just gone to show me that, okay, you know, buyers are kind of like, buyers have sort of dried up, and then people, your approval rate for what you can get approved for these houses are starting to go down, right? So mm-hmm. that's like allowing me, and I know there's a whole bunch of other people who are in my situation. That's kind of allowing me to see that, okay, maybe consumer patterns will start changing within next year. And I think you're 100% right. Right. Sorry.
And I always like to point out that the hard part of these predictions is that really nobody knows, right? And if I rewind the clock to a year ago, 12 months ago, there was a lot of negativity going into 23. I was very, very negative. I really thought we were about to hit a wall. When I look at, you know, the overall stock market and what it did last year, it bottomed around, you know, the S&P bottomed around 3,600 in June of 2022, and it rebounded, and then it got back to that level around September, October of 2022. And then the end of the year of 2022, you know, there was a pretty strong sell-off for kind of tax loss harvesting. But then going into 23, it was overall, I would say, relatively positive. You know, things rebounded. You know, it wasn't the end of the world. There was enough fear, I think, that it forced people to kind of make some decisions in terms of what they want to hold, what they want to sell, planning for the worst. But the worst really did not happen. And 23 overall, I would say, has been a very good year for most industries. You know, mm-hmm. capital has been flowing definitely more selectively and definitely kind of slowly to begin the year, but quicker later on. We've had selective IPOs. We've had, you know, selectively debt being done, even in the cannabis industry, where, again, the first half of the year really bad, But we did have a flurry of deal making, you know, post August of this year, which again has slowed down again. So, so we really haven't seen the distress that people like myself thought we were going to have this year. And ultimately, the consumer has not slowed down. In cannabis, we've actually seen a flattening and a rebounding of prices, especially in key markets like California and Michigan. And I mean, that nobody really talks about that. But to me, that is one of the brightest spots of the year. The fact that markets that we were very, very concerned about have actually started to go the other way. And that shows that there is bottom pricing in cannabis and a floor under some of these things.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, originally when you asked that question, you also did talk about this earnings season being quite robust for cannabis companies. And then talking about the California and Michigan market pricing, I do think that there were a lot of cannabis companies, like smaller ones, PrivCos, even like smaller PubCos that did default, right? That didn't go, that are no longer in operations or didn't get the funding to get operated. Like I know in Missouri, there was a whole bunch of licenses that were granted, but some of these companies couldn't get the money to get operational, but they're still holding the license, right? So I think the earnings that you're seeing is being amalgamated to all to the stronger players, right? So it's getting consolidated to the big guys. That's why you're seeing these earnings like get better and better and better, is because you're just scooping up what all the little guys have left over. So I think like the pie, I don't know, and I could be wrong, but maybe the pie has grown a little bit, but the slices have gotten a lot bigger for the people who are more well established, right? And the same can also be said for the broader market. You know, a lot of these companies are being propped up by tech companies, like that by the tech names. I think there was a stat that came out and it was like the top 10% of the S&P 500 are basically holding up the S&P 500. Right. And I said this once before, I think I said this back in August or September, but a lot of the buy side funds that I speak with, you know, you talk to a lot of these portfolio managers and they're not bullish in the economy or in the stocks, but they're like, hey, we have to capitulate because we cannot stay in cash because they're facing redemptions. So a lot of their clients are redeeming their funds because they don't want to be, because they're just holding cash. And so, you know, you're now seeing people saying, okay, it doesn't matter if we're bullish or bearish, but we do have to put the money, we do have to put that money to work. So maybe that's why you're starting to see little transactions here happen here and there, right?
Yeah. The other thing that's happening too is that you're starting to see some of the deeper cracks form. So to give an example in real estate, you know, over the last, say, 30 to 60 days, we've seen a lot of kind of large-scale projects hit receivership. And it seems like every week we're hearing about one. And some of them are large-scale. Some of them are the result of fraud. So it's you know, the although rates have kind of been up for over a year now, it's only now that the music is kind of slowing down or stopping. For some of the most egregious examples, right? And that has to get cleaned up. And that kind of puts a chill into some of the lending entities out there, which kind of helps precipitate a slowdown because there's not new money available for the most people. And the new money coming in is very selective on quality and leverage and all that kind of stuff. So it's, to your point, there is a creative destructive process that has to happen. So these kind of booms and busts can be healthy because when there's too much money out there for too long, people kind of get reckless, you know, and you don't really need to be that discerning in your credit quality and your decision making. But you know, one of the things we were talking about before we started is that kind of slowly what happened is you saw a lot of the let's call it the pandemic professions in quotations have gone away. So you don't really hear about people day trading anymore. You don't hear about, you know, people with the laser eyes and the crypto bros anymore, right? And you know, cannabis is kind of part of that. You don't hear people bragging about being part of the MSO gang, right? You don't have people at Thanksgiving probably telling their families about how they have to buy cannabis now, right, before the next thing comes. So I would say the word to me is normalization. There's been a lot of normalization of activity that probably shouldn't have been that way during the pandemic. And this is the year that it really got evened out. I think the surprising bit is it didn't necessarily go backwards the way we thought it might have, right? Like, you know, Bitcoin's not worthless. You know, a lot of things that that we might have thought were going to completely get upended didn't. So in some ways, it's been kind of a really tame rolling, almost like a rolling recession in terms of what people have had to deal with. People have had a lot of opportunity to kind of adjust their behavior in the last year and change.
And yeah, to your point, I mean, you know, I follow the luxury watch market. Not
here we
I'm
go.
No, I'm not in it. It's just
the
a
Rolex
good indicator.
Indicator. Yes.
Yeah, the Chrono 24 has a watch indicator, and it's down significantly, right, from the highs. It's still out of my price range, but
we'll keep an eye on it. So,
yeah, exactly.
So look, talking about earnings, one of the companies I want to highlight here is Verano. So we had a little bit of time this week because it was a little bit of a slower news cycle. So one of the things I got to do was actually go through Verano's latest release. And they did something really interesting, which was they broke out their results for retail and wholesale on a state-by-state basis. So this is the first time I've ever seen this. There is a private company that I'm an investor in that does this that I used to watch, you know, very closely because of the data it would give. I haven't seen a public company do this other than I think Vireo used to do this, but they're relatively small, so it didn't matter as much. So I want to actually go through these numbers and just kind of share some of the quick analysis I did and talk about what this actually means for the industry. So anyone who hasn't seen this, it's in their Q3 news release. If you scroll down to somewhere towards the bottom, there's breakdowns state by state for retail sales as well as wholesale. And yeah, one of the really interesting things was, so what I did is I started with the retail sales. And I guess the first thing that was really interesting here is just the fact that you get some really good insight as to how big these states are for them, right? So if you had asked me, I would have told you that Florida, Illinois, New Jersey, Arizona, and Pennsylvania are kind of their five biggest states. That to me, I don't think was surprising. I think what was surprising is the proportion of these states. So Florida, for example, did just over 53 million of sales at the retail level. And Illinois and New Jersey were both around 30. So, and keep in mind, from a seasonal perspective, Q3 is not a good time for Florida because, you know, that's the peak of Florida summer. But despite that, you know, pretty massive numbers compared to what they have in Illinois and New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. And so what are your thoughts on, I mean, the other states?
Yeah, I mean, everything below that is significantly lower. You know, Arizona at 17, PA at 13, Maryland at 10. I think it's probably really important to note that if you look at these on a per store basis, it's going to be totally different, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Illinois, they've got 10 stores, right? So you're talking about $3 million, you know, per store per quarter. New Jersey, you got three stores, right? So you talk about $10 million per store per quarter, right? So, and then in Florida, you know, you've got upwards of 60 stores. So, you know, the huge, huge deltas there, right? So, So very, very different numbers. But still, I was surprised by the sheer size of what you're looking at. Another really interesting state, by the way, Maryland. So Maryland, $10.5 million of sales. When you compare that to the 9 month, they did about 17 in 9 months, right? Including the 10. So what that means is that from Q2 to Q3, they basically tripled when they went from medical to rec. You're seeing a 3x effect for their stores in Maryland. So obviously that's, you know, a huge delta. And I think you're probably seeing very, very profitable change in those Maryland numbers as well.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the other things to look at too, Abby, is when you look at Pennsylvania, right? I guess you asked about other states. I'm surprised by how small some of the other states are in context now that we can see the full breakdown. You know, I wouldn't have guessed that, you know, Florida, Illinois, and New Jersey are driving basically half of the sales. That it seems large to me, based on the kind of footprint that Verano has. And Verano has probably a more diversified footprint than almost anybody else in the industry. So that's one thing that stood out to me, is how much concentration risk there is in just these three states.
But Florida and Illinois, they're pretty well-established states, right? Compared to like Arizona. Like, don't get me wrong, Arizona is a well-established state, but it's not mm-hmm. it's not as long as Florida or Illinois, right? So, you know, is it just that some of these other states, these fringe states, whatever you want to call it, are just a little bit more nascent, smaller population? So, like, you know, they're not going to reach that size.
Mm-hmm.
They don't attract as much tourism, right? So, like, you know, that could be playing into a big factor too.
Yeah, so I mean, look, let's look at them, right? So I think if you look at PA, like PA and Illinois are roughly the same size, and in PA they did 13 million of sales. PA is med only, right? So if mm-hmm. they went rec tomorrow and that tripled, then you'd be, you know, a decent amount above Illinois, but they have more stores in PA as well, right? I guess to answer what you're asking, I mean, it really depends kind of state by state what you're looking at. I don't think there's a clear cut answer per se, but you know, Florida, I would agree with you. Like, that program probably has already been compressed. And I wouldn't be too worried. Like, I think the only like direction in Florida is probably upwards. If we can actually get rec on the ballot, right, then I think everyone gets excited again for Florida. Illinois and New Jersey, I think you're looking at kind of different points of the spectrum. So
yeah.
New Jersey, what I did is I actually compared their Q3 results multiplied by 3 versus their 9-month results. So what that means is it's looking at, is Q3, how does Q3 compare to the rest of the year so far, right? And so Maryland obviously stands out in that Q3 was way better than the rest of the year. Kind of obvious because they went rec. But New Jersey, they had the opposite effect. So in New Jersey, there was actually a big slowdown in Q3 compared to what they've done the first two quarters of the year. And if you think about the fact that it's summertime, that's not so good, right? So you're actually seeing in New Jersey, now the question is this, are they just seeing more competition as more stores open in New Jersey? Are they seeing price competition and that they're having to compress the prices? And I don't have a clear answer on that. It's probably a bit of both, right? In mm-hmm. Illinois, it was pretty much flat, you know, normalizing for the nine months, right? Again, that's not good because Q3 is an exceptional quarter, right? So if you're flat compared to your other quarters, that shows to me that there's a slowdown happening in Illinois on the retail side, right? Florida being flat overall for Q3 is actually good news because Q3 is a bad month. So you would expect it to be down. If it's flat, that's actually positive, right? To your point on where these states actually are, I think New Jersey, you're at risk of further slowdown in price compression because you still have more stores opening. You have more grows coming online.
Mm-hmm.
Illinois, you have more stores opening because there have been more licenses issued. The biggest problem you're going to have in Illinois, jumping ahead, is for the most part, Illinois is not going to have any big grows come online. But as we'll get to next, you know, Forefront, which is a company that has a lot of financial issues that are bearing out this quarter, they have a huge grow, like basically a maxed out grow, which they're bringing online in stages. And they say by the end of the year should be fully operational. And the only hope a company like Forefront has is to really dump its product on the wholesale market to try to earn back kind of what it's put in. And that could have a really negative impact, not just on Verano, but the entire Illinois market. And when you see that Illinois is making up, you know, in the neighborhood of, you know, 20% of a company's sales, it's actually not maybe as high as I would have thought for Verano, but it's still a big chunk of dough that could get hit here.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting to watch, especially in Illinois. I mean, the Illinois markets has, you know, since it's come online, has had obviously a lot of challenges. They've issued a lot more licenses. So it would be quite impactful, right?
Yeah, I mean, Illinois is one of the markets that has really delivered for the operators. Mm-hmm. And it's been slowly getting more competitive. But, you know, kind of jumping ahead to forefront, my big concern is that you have an opportunity for someone, you know, a one-off operator who is going really big to completely blow out the numbers, right? And that that Illinois project for Forefront is sort of a vestige of how things used to be. That was funded by IIP, well before the slowdown started, and it just has mm-hmm. taken a long time to actually come online. I don't think there would be any capital in the market today for somebody to say, I want to build a 200,000 square foot facility out to max, because it just, the numbers wouldn't make sense, and I don't think mm-hmm. anybody would finance it.
Yeah.
The other thing that was really interesting, Abby, is I just touched on the retail numbers. I also want to talk about the wholesale numbers. So the wholesale numbers, if you look at, they have two numbers they did. They have a number called gross and a number called net. So what this is that when they run their wholesale business, essentially their cultivation business, they also are selling product to themselves. So the gross number essentially is all of the product that they grew and sold in the quarter. But the net number is they take out the intercompany sales. So they're not double counting the selling to themselves. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the net number is the real wholesale number. Now you can look at it as a percentage to say, kind of look at, hey, how much are we actually wholesaling to third parties versus how much are we selling to ourselves, right? And the higher the number, the more you're actually selling to third parties as opposed to yourself. So that was really interesting, because the highest states were Connecticut at 75% and Maryland at almost 65%. So, you know, the two states that went rec most recently. So probably the two states where you're getting the highest dollar per pound for wholesale, right? And the third state was New Jersey at almost 62%. So that was a state, again, states where you're probably getting the highest bang for your buck selling wholesale. The interesting thing was, again, comparing it to the 9 month and then normalizing it, where mm-hmm. the biggest changes were. And the biggest changes were actually in New Jersey as well as Arizona. So Arizona had a big drop off this quarter, which, again, slower time for Arizona being the summertime. And New Jersey had a big step up. So they were actually selling a whole lot more wholesale in New Jersey as opposed to selling to themselves. And again, I wonder if this is just a seasonal effect, and the fact that there's just more demand for the product right now in New Jersey, and they're able to get better spot pricing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is there, I mean, I don't know if you know this or not, but is there like a magic number that these companies try to hit, right, in terms of what they do to sell to others versus sell through their own like vertically integrated channels?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, again, this is the first time we're seeing this kind of information out of Verano and really any leading multi-state operator. So there's really nothing to compare this to, right? I think to me, the information from Verano is really interesting, because I believe this is a team that really knows how to maximize dollars. So I think there's some intention behind numbers. And, you know, I'm kind of comfortable saying, hey, if the New Jersey wholesale percentages went up, then it's probably because they did so opportunistically. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't have any magic formula for what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah. Because I figure, like, you know, if their wholesale numbers are great, it looks good on paper, but mm-hmm. they probably capture more of a margin if they're vertically integrated. Right? On their vertically integrated sales.
Yeah, no question, right? I mean, you're going to get the most margin selling in your own store. Mm-hmm. There's no question for that, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, look, just kind of going through it, like Florida, New Jersey, Illinois, like Florida represented roughly $160 million of sales for the year. And then New Jersey and Illinois were both around 130 to 135. So remember, Florida, you've got a ton of stores, over 60 stores. New Jersey, you've got 3. And Illinois, you've got 10, right? So mm-hmm. pretty interesting that New Jersey is definitely the workhorse, given the number of stores. And Florida, by the way, it's about 73 stores. So you've only got about $2 million per store for 9 months, whereas New Jersey, you know, you've got like over $40 million per store, although that includes some wholesale as well. That's not the fair number. Mm-hmm. And Illinois, same thing, right? Like it's more in the range of $10 million a store. So some pretty massive discrepancies here between these. Illinois, by the way, on retail alone is about $9 million for the 9 months of the year, and New Jersey is about $30 million per store. So pretty huge swings there. And by the way, part of me is kind of, you know, I've been saying that for a long time. We needed more disclosure from these companies. So a lot of credit to Verano for giving it here. I'm not sure what the reason was, if they had to or if they just decided to. Part of me is kind of happy that we didn't have these numbers for a long time, because the amount of analysis we would be doing state by state, company by company, would have been absolutely insane. So I'm a little bit glad that we never had these numbers. Okay, moving on. I want to compare this. So this is obviously, I think, a very positive development, being able to see state by state what's going on. I want to compare this to, you know, pulling up the financials for Forefront. And I've kind of talked about Forefront a couple times in terms of not really having a lot of cash, it being a going concern, and it being a company that, you know, I don't follow all that closely, but a company that I would be concerned about if I was a equity holder. So I don't mean to pick on, you know, this company, but I do think it's important to talk about. So I'm just pulling up their financial statement, and I'm going to page 28 out of 46 on their statement. And what this is a note called subsequent events, okay? And subsequent events are essentially after the quarter ended, anything that happened that you need to include. And you know, you get sometimes, hey, we did a deal or this happened or whatever, but they have a ton of subsequent events to speak about. And for the most part, almost all of these are financing related. So from October to November, there have just been a ton of, you know, entering into new notes, amending old notes. And on the one hand, you go, hey, at least they're, you know, being proactive about, you know, moving these pieces around. But on the other hand, when you read through some of these things, I mean, this company's in a really scary position, right? Like they're short on cash. They've taken all kinds of debt out. And, you know, they've had to extend a bunch of notes. They've had to pay, you know, warrants to people. They've had to pay class A shares to people to try to settle some of these things. So I kind of look at this, and this is an example to me of a situation that you would have expected would have been cleaned up sooner in a higher interest rate, more selective capital markets environment. But this is a story to watch, because pretty soon, and I don't know if that's, you know, 3 months, 6 months, but pretty soon something has to happen here, and somebody's got to pay the piper. So, you know, as an example, I'm just going to point out here that on October 13th, they entered into a new senior secured credit facility for up to $10 million. They got $6 million drawn right away. Okay. So you look at that and you go, oh, okay. You know, that's great. But then the rate is prime plus seven. The greater of prime plus 7 and 15.5%. Okay. So, you know, pretty big number. On top of that, the loan matures on December the 1st. So the loan was granted on October 13th and it's maturing, I mean, basically 6 weeks later. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a head scratcher, right? They had to pay a 7% origination fee on the loan. And they're going to pay an exit fee of $1.4 million, which if they draw the whole loan, that's a 14% exit fee. So you got a 7% setup fee, a 14% exit fee, and 15% interest for a loan that's going to expire 6 weeks from being drawn.
Yeah, but keep in mind, all those numbers are annualized, right? And you're not going to pay that full amount within the 4 weeks or 6 weeks, sorry.
Well, on the interest, yes, agreed, yeah. Right? But the fees, the number is the number.
Yes.
right? So I guess the point I'm getting to here is that this, I look at this and I'm really scratching my head as to like what's going on here, right? There's a note as well on the bottom of this saying the proceeds of these loans shall be used only to acquire and build out dispensaries in Illinois, resolve certain liabilities and pay expenses related to the transaction. So there's a very limited impact of what they can actually do with all this. And they're supposed to have a minimum liquidity of $3 million starting on December 31st. So when I see all of this, now, again, I'm not that, like, I don't have great knowledge about this company, but when I see things like this, you know, this gets me pretty worried about, like, how are they going to get out of this, right? And where I think this ties into the broader market and other companies is they're really hanging their hat on the turning on of this Illinois facility. This Illinois facility has been in the works for a very long time. It's, you know, basically a maximum size facility, over 200,000 square feet with a full canopy size of 100,000 square feet. So that is going to be a massive addition to the Illinois market, and that is going to drag the wholesale market considerably. And what this reminds me of, Abby, is a time that is no longer where companies were coming, you know, to you and saying, hey, we want to raise, you know, whatever, 5, 10, 20 million bucks. We're making, you know, $4,000 a pound wholesaling our flower in 10,000 square feet. We want to borrow a ton of money to expand that to 100,000 square feet. And, you know, we're going to be basically 10x our sales, right? And you would say, well, hey, that's a lot of product. What's going to happen to the price? They say, yeah, we've modeled going from 4,000 a pound to 3,500 a pound, you know, like a 10% pullback. But the reality is when everyone's blowing out their canopy, it ends up being a lot worse on pricing. So long-winded way of saying I'm very concerned about what could happen in the Illinois market here, because the only way out of this for Forefront is to unload a whole lot of product into the Illinois market.
Yeah, yeah. And then on in regarding to those debt terms, I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's sort of where we are in this industry, right? We're constrained for capital. We're in a rising rate environment. Like, you know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, them's the apples.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you got to do what you got to do. And, you know, companies just don't just throw the towel in, right? They have to figure out something. And if they have to take onerous debt terms in order to, you know, buy themselves a couple of months or a couple of weeks, then that's what you got to do, right? But right. It's the situation is such that it will impact other companies as well, not just Forefront. So I think that's something to keep a really close eye on. By the way, IIPR owns that Illinois facility, I believe. So it will be interesting to see here, to hear what they say and what happens because of it. So that's you know, a situation that's not so good and could impact other companies. And probably one of the wildest situations is the Planet 13 situation, where the company reported mid-November that they have over $20 million of cash that they are unable to access because of this really random black swan event where there's a company called El Capitan that was holding the money for them as, you know, I guess an investment manager or investment advisor, SEC registered. And because of a judgment against El Capitan, basically the accounts that Planet 13 owns have effectively been, you know, seized. And they're not sure, you know, if or when they're going to get that $20+ million back. And that's almost 60% of their cash. And I think this just highlights, you know, the risks of, you know, investing in general and this industry, right? What can happen in really weird scenarios that, you know, it seems like the company's not really at fault at all here, but, you know, they're the ones and shareholders are the ones who take the brunt of it.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate to lock up $21.5 million. That's crazy.
And yeah, we know that this is not a small amount of money in today's market, right? It's not easy to raise $20 million.
No, not at all.
By the way, I just went just to search the IIPR Illinois point, and I found this press release from 2021 where it talks about IIPR purchasing it, purchasing the property, and then kind of committing to something like $50 million to build out the full 250,000 square feet. Yeah, it also mentions that IIPR's total investments to 4Front will be over $80 million, which at the time I guess was a good thing. Today, not such a good thing, right? So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I mean, it's definitely in IIP's best interest for 4Front to succeed here, right? That's not a facility they want to take back. But, you know, if they're charging 12 to 14% on $50 million, I mean, those are big numbers, right? You're talking $6 to $7 million just on net rent, not including all the additional rent and the facilities and all that. So that's an example of a deal that you just could not do under any circumstance in today's market.
It's unfortunate, but hey.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out and see what implications that has for the broader cannabis market. Okay, a couple other items I want to touch on before we close out in terms of the state of the industry. The Ohio cannabis vote happened. That was issue two. So we've talked about that, you know, a couple times. The final tally was 57 to 43. So 57% of people voting yes, 43% voting no. It's called issue number two. And a really interesting tidbit I haven't heard people talk about, and shout out to Marijuana Moment for reporting on this. Vivek Ramaswamy, who previously had said that he is for legalizing cannabis, he actually said he voted against it. He's from Ohio, and presumably he voted for the issue one and two. And they asked him why, right? Why would you vote against it? And he had a pretty lame excuse, in my opinion, which was that he said, well, you know, it doesn't make sense that state and federal law don't match up. And, you know, I don't want to vote for this to say yes at the state level when the federal level doesn't jive with this. And I think it's completely nonsensical, by the way. But I think what it tells you is that I think he wanted to be on the side of saying that he didn't vote for this. And I don't know if that sort of means he's obviously not going to be the candidate, but maybe he's kind of positioning himself accordingly for being a running mate or being in a cabinet and doesn't want to be too far out of step with what Republicans think on the issue. But I thought that was a really, really interesting tidbit from a guy who had otherwise been kind of very pro cannabis in the Republican Party. So the other thing I want to point out too is that there's really only two issues on the ballot, right? Cannabis was issue number two, but issue number one was abortion rights. And I actually think that's the right order, right? I think abortion is a much more pressing and important issue for most voters over cannabis. But interestingly, the numbers were basically identical in Ohio. I mean, 57-43, almost exactly, that, you know, people voted to enshrine abortion rights in Ohio and protect abortion rights the same as they voted for cannabis to be legal.
I wonder if it's the same people voting.
I mean, that's a big question too, right? If it drove the same kind of people out, and I don't know, I'm sure you could actually go and, you know, look at the vote counts and people like Hirsch, who are deeply involved in politics, do that stuff. So it'd be interesting to hear his full breakdown of the data. But I mean, look, this is a victory. It's not a 60% plus blowout victory. But nonetheless, I mean, this is a positive for cannabis. And sort of going back to, you know, those Verano results, Ohio is actually a state that was a pretty small percentage of Verano's results and was actually slowing down in Q3. So I think, you know, the good news is when you look at kind of what's on deck for next year, you know, Maryland, you're going to have sales expansion, and Ohio, you know, that's going to hit at some point and you're going to have sales expansion. So, I mean, that's going to be a rare bright spot state by state for the industry next year.
Yeah, Ohio's been a state that we've been watching for quite some time, and I don't know. I always thought it would come on a lot sooner, but hey, it's going to come on when it does, and I think it'll be pretty exciting when it does too, right? Because it's kind of like that missing piece in the Midwest. I guess Indiana's still there too.
Yeah, I mean, look, Ohio is, now we know it's coming, right? The laws are written very favorably in that there's a defined clock. So I think if you look at Q2, maybe let's call it Q3 of next year, you're going to have another event sort of like we had this year with Maryland. And that's a positive, mm-hmm. right? And we got to appreciate the positives where they are. Yeah. So to round it out, I mean, two last pieces I want to chat about are the David Boies lawsuit, which is, if you remember, Ascend was trying to do this a couple years ago. I think actually in 22 they were trying to do this, and they just couldn't get the money. Well, now the lawsuit's been launched. It's a little unclear to me when I read the articles on what this lawsuit's actually trying to achieve. My understanding was that they were trying to challenge 280E and say that it conflicted with states' laws or states' rights. But now it's apparently 280E, but also interstate commerce related, which I don't quite understand. So I just kind of wanted to point this out because it is something we haven't really talked about, but probably nothing is actually materially going to happen with this for some time. And even then it's probably a long shot, but hey, it's something that's out there. The other thing I wanted to just mention on is safer banking, right? Senator Schumer kind of coming out and saying, hey, I've been working on this. We need more GOP votes. I can't do a floor vote until we have more GOP votes. So it's unclear to me exactly what the game is here and what he's kind of aiming for. Does he need more GOP votes? I don't know, right? Is he waiting to try to see which way the wind is blowing before putting some equity in this thing? I don't know, right? On top of that, I mean, even if we get everything we want and it's passed by the Senate, I mean, who's to say this is going to get any play in the House now that you have a pretty anti-cannabis House speaker, right? So I don't know. I'm not particularly excited by the prospect of safer banking. I think that if we get it, great. I think we should have already had it by now. But I wouldn't put too much stock in this as compared to, the impact of something like rescheduling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think I was even seeing on Twitter that a lot of people were just discounting this completely.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's where we're at. And then lastly, on rescheduling, I mean, obviously this has been the story of 2023. I think this will be the story of 2024. I would just caution there's been some kind of, I don't know if it's a rumor or if it's just, excitement or optimism, but people seem to think that we're going to be getting an imminent decision on Schedule 3, meaning like before the end of the year. I don't know exactly where that's coming from. If we get it, great. I would be thrilled. I just would be surprised. We had Ryan Mao from Solar Cannabis on a couple episodes ago who did a great breakdown. There were some people, by the way, who commented that there's an issue with the treaties and will it comply with that? Will it not comply with that? I'm not going to pretend I know all these things. I really don't. But I just keep coming back to the core idea that this is something that's designed for political purposes to help them get votes next November, right? And that's going to be a big theme of 2024, that everything's going to be political. Everything's going to be through the lens of what helps people win votes come November of 2024. So I think that it bodes very well for rescheduling, but I would be surprised if that, big announcement mic drop moment didn't happen like right before the election. That would be surprising to me. So there could be different phases of it. We'll see. But we'll go into this on the next episode where I really want to put forward kind of my game plan for 2024. But I just want to say that I think that people are setting themselves up to be a little bit disappointed going into the end of the year, with this expectation of something happening, before the end of the year. But I actually think there's reasons to believe that 24 could be a really interesting year for the industry, and it could be an opportunity to maybe add to my cannabis position, which is what I've kind of been ruminating over. And we'll come back next episode and kind of walk through an overview of the year and a game plan going into 2024. Okay, everybody, thank you so much for listening. CINpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.